just wanted to mention a bit about Bowlby and his attachment theory. I'm very conscious there are people sitting here who know loads more about this than I do. I think especially those of you who are training the young people's course and so on, I think, because it's just so relevant in child development. So I'm not going to spend loads of time on it, but I just think it's relevant. So how you obviously form an attachment with your primary caregiver and how that impacts you. So I think your sexuality at any given point really is based on sort of inherited endowments you're getting, plus then obviously life experience and what it brings your way. But that sort of what's endowed on you, how you connect with your primary caregiver, which tends to be the mother, is obviously going to have just a massive impact. You're getting those messages. Is it okay to touch and to be close? And or is the mother giving off mixed messages whereby she's not consistent? And so you're trying to seek approval and trying to be noticed, but sometimes she might hug you when you fall down and look after you. And then the next breath, she's saying, oh, come on, stop it, knock it off. And then you think, oh, I don't know. Can I cry? Can't I? Can I be hurt? Can't I? Am I loved? Aren't I? Am I going to be hugged or not? And then you don't know what to do with that. And so you left really quite insecure. And you're learning things like emotional regulation, you know, how extreme can I be in what I'm thinking and feeling. And it's that natural instinct to want to touch and to hold and to be close. And so in any sort of healthy sort of connection with your primary caregiver, there is a lot of closeness and stroking and of babies. And as they get older, you know, if you fall over, hug you, come on. But what happens if you don't get that? And so you're not used to feeling that it's okay to be touched and to be loved. Yeah. Talk about Esther Perel in the second half after the break. But I do like what she says. I'll say who she is and so on. She's an author and she speaks internationally and about relationships and keeping almost the erotic, the sex life going, as it were. And I love her quote, they tell me how you are loved and I will tell you how you make love, which I think is quite profound. And then with the sexual script, which is just really a variation of, yeah, what you grow up with and what's imprinted on you. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm just going to move on from this because I'm conscious of time. Basic stages. I would just say there, yeah, your prenatal stage, of course, you're just born with this blank canvas, like I've said, childhood, all the things imprinted on you and what you see, you know, outside when you go to school and so on. Adolescence, I am going to talk a bit about in the next section. Getting married, what happens there, and I'm going to talk about that as well. And when I say when you get married, in any stable relationship, as I say, it doesn't have to be a heterosexual relationship at all, but just in a relationship, what happens with your sex life. Parenthood, of course, seriously impacts your sex life and your lives as a couple, because you start out just being really into each other, and then along comes a baby, and suddenly dad is not so important because baby is everything. Parents are tired, and so there's a lot that goes with that. Midlife, yeah, according to all teenagers, of course, we don't have sex anymore. That's just, you know. But of course, we are living longer. We are healthier than ever before, so we've got loads of years to have sex. And that was, I'll come to it in a bit, but my dissertation topic was about sex and, you know, in middle age. And oh, you want it to carry on. You don't want it all to die off. That would be quite depressing.
Hang on, before you do that.
Yeah.
I'm very interested that Bancroft hasn't put geriatric sex.
Yeah.
Well, he hasn't. That's quite true.
When is midlife and when is it not? You know, I mean, just
I suppose.
You're pushing it to maybe 60. Maybe.
Yeah.
It's very strange that it's not recognised that old people actually have some.
What year was he? 2009. It's not that long ago either.
I ought to write to him.
I think you should. Challenge the man. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Sorry, it just really stuck
out to
me.
No, but that's actually a good point. Yeah.
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 I was thinking that. What is an increase in sexually transmitted diseases with, like, the over 60s?
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Sarah, can you say it again? I can't hear you. Sorry. Can you say it again?
There's been an increase with sexually transmitted diseases.
Yeah.
The over
60s. Really?
Yeah.
They do have sex though.
I was on a poster in the doctors.
Really?
Because they're not always staying within the same marriage like they used to.
Yeah.
And because, I'm not going to get pregnant, don't need to use anything.
Interesting.
That is, I didn't know that. Yeah. Okay, obviously the biggest thing that lies at the bottom of so much of our stuff that goes on with sex is shame. And what shame leads to, the worst part of shame, is humiliation and everything that goes with it and what it raises for you. And I would say, the main source of failure to achieve adult sexual satisfaction is an interference early in life with a child's discovery of his or her own body as a source of pleasure. Our bodies are to be enjoyed, like we enjoy eating or drinking or touching, having sex, living life. We should enjoy our bodies, but so often we grow up not liking bits of our bodies, being ashamed of them, trying to hide them, and certainly not enjoying ourselves as sexual beings and everything that goes with it. So it's the basis of so much repression that we have. I remember one of my lecturers saying this, that shame is a wound made from the inside, dividing us from ourselves and others. And she went on to say that shame indicates an unmet longing. It was Katie who said that, I remember, and thinking an unmet longing. And in many ways it is. And she gave the example, actually, she said, your shame comes in all different ways. So, for instance, if you're walking along the street and, oh, hi, you think you know that person and they look and you don't know them and you feel an idiot. You feel embarrassed, but why? So to do with that unmet longing, oh, that was somebody I knew. Oh, no, it's not. So, I haven't given it a lot of thought, but I wanted to just say that because I think that's quite an interesting point. And I remember it struck me at the time. So I was trying to think of the types of shame that I experienced and what unmet longing that could actually be. But when we're feeling shame, we feel small and we don't have eye contact. We shrink and we become less of ourselves and we don't feel good about ourselves. And, it leads to guilty feelings. And when you feel small, you're not looking somebody in the eye. And so what occurred to me with sex is, how comfortable are you, for instance, when you're having sex, actually looking your lover in the eye? Or is it easier to just lie back and not look in that intense moment of orgasm, for example? So if you can't look somebody in the eye, what is that about? What are you ashamed of? Is, God, do we all make funny faces probably in that great moment? Or what are we doing and moaning and all of that? So yes, why do we feel embarrassed though? So yeah, I think shame just lies so much at the bottom of it. And because of shame, there's a topic that, when I was researching, I wasn't going to talk about this, but it just became more and more and more relevant, and that is, I just want to share, I'll leave that. Shame leads us to attack somebody else, attack yourself, and avoid. So just quickly relating that obviously to your sex life, all of those can impact as a result of shame. But I'll leave it there because of time.